Welcome back to The Bookshelf. I'm Caleb Mannin, continuing the reading of my 2015 novel, Bust It Like a Mule, The Tale of Cotton King Fisher. Chapter 28. When Cotton wakes up, he sees the minister has left him some food out of the church food bank barrel. Goddamn canned beans, but food just the same. And Cotton eats them cold beans from the can and waits for a train. Then he sees someone else coming up on him, and it is Fred Mason, his boss friend. And Cotton don't want Mason to see him like this, so he covers himself in his blanket and rolls over as he is too broke up to walk away. Cotton, Mason hollers, come on, man. I heard about what happened to you and Jacob. JL came to me and said they were planning on getting you, but I was too late. I'm sorry, friend, I really am. Now come on, Elsa's made a bed up for you and some food and the kids are worried. Come on home with me and rest up. No, Cotton says through his blanket on his head. Why the hell not, you stubborn bull? 'Cause the earth don't want me here, and when the earth don't want you, you gotta get rolling. What? Fred Mason says all angry like. I have never heard you talk like that before, you goddamn son of a bitch. Stop being a baby and get up and get with us. There's a fire up north and we need you. Terry doesn't know enough to handle it alone. And when Fred says the name Terry, Cotton gets angry that his friend Fred Mason still has Terry on the fire crew, though he is a man and he knows this is just the way it is with men, whether good or bad. I'm leaving, so forget about me, Cotton says, and Mason gets angry and hollers, are you really just going to leave us like that? What if the forest burns down? And Cotton says, let her burn. And Fred Mason says, damn you then, you big son of a bitch. I thought more of you than that. And he drops a picnic basket with food that Elsa has made for Cotton. And he turns and goes, for there is a fire. And he fears it might get worse before it gets better. Even worse since Terry is leading the crew and he feels sick about his friend the bull Cotton King Fisher being broke down like that. It was worse than he thought. After Mason goes, Cotton can eat some food, so he does. He eats Elsa Mason's cold fried chicken and homemade bread. And he wonders how many days he has been out, and he thinks it is several, but he can't tell. He eats and sleeps and hears a train go by in his sleep, but he can't wake up for it. And the next day, someone comes to see him, and by God, it is Big Sky Woman JL. But he sits like a hobo Indian chief, who has lost his tribe and lands with his Indian blanket around his shoulders, not looking up at the girl. JL kneels down next to him, and he won't look at her, and she gets awful sad to see him so, and still bloody and muddy and all, and she whispers, are you okay? And he says, do I look okay to you? And she has to admit that he does not indeed look okay to her, for he has lost the fire in his belly as well as his body. I am sorry, Cotton, she says. I am sorry this happened to you. And he don't want to talk about it or hear pity from a beautiful girl, especially a beauty mark girl he is so fond of. For Cotton is built of flesh and blood and bone and gristle, held together with pride, by God. So he turns his head a bit away from her and says, I don't need you to feel sorry for me, and I won't cause no more trouble, 'cause I'm leaving. And she says, after all this, you were just giving up? And he gets angry when she says this, and he says, I ain't never give up, Missy. But he still won't look at her, and she goes on, you always give up. You move from place to place every time it gets too hard for you. I thought that the land where the world began and all was more than that, and I thought you would lick Terry clean into the ground before you would just give up on this place or me. And she says three things that go in like bullets and come out the other side. And one is that he always gives up. And the other is that he's give up on the land where the world began. And another thing that hurts is the third thing that he gave up on her. And this hurts the worst, so bad that he does not even have an answer. And they are both quiet, man and woman like Adam and Eve sitting sad outside the garden after God booted them out. And the Blackfeet wind picks up off the mountains like that night outside the bowling alley under the big sky, but in its coolness is fire. Cotton sits there like a goddang hobo engine chief with his blanket round his shoulders staring at nothing, just not at JL. And JL is squat right down next to him, and she goes, You can't quit now, Cotton Kingfisher. And Cotton growls, I ain't never quit. It's just the getting is good and you gotta get when it is. And JL says, you are a coward. And she is trying to make old Cotton mad, and hell if she didn't, for he turns to her and says, you're an ornery little sh. Don't take that tone with me. See, you haven't lost the fire in your belly yet, so get up and use it, by God, JL says, all riled up black. For she is not used to seeing Cotton broke down, and she don't like it. And she wished he weren't broke, for when a man is broke, it weighs down a woman's soul. For she knows she can't fix it, but it still hurts her in the ribs. You once told me to put it all on you, and I did, damn it. And now you are just taking it all back, and I never would have put it all on you if I'd have known you weren't worth betting on. Then she hands Cotton a wad of something, and it is the goddamn cash she won in the match, and she says, I haven't spent any of it, not a red cent, and I don't want it, because it isn't right to take money that you didn't win. So you take it, you stubborn ass. And Cotton growls, leave off. You won that fair and square just like I won the fight. For it makes him powerful angry to hear a woman talk to him so, and they ain't never, for he is an ornery cuss. Though he has never hit a woman, by God, but they would never want to tempt him to in the first place, is what I am saying to you. J.O. just keeps her hand out and sticks it in Cotton's face, and he gets angry and grabs her wrist, and he wonders at it, for it is so thin-like that he could break it like a chicken bone, though she is a hearty woman, and he says, get that trash out of my face. And JL says, are you going to black my other eye? And this hurts Cotton like nothing ain't ever hurt him before. Like a knife gash he had once, but worse. For no knife cuts so deep as a woman saying something like that to a man. We all know it, by God, so let's not pretend it ain't so. I'm not telling no fairy tale. I'm telling a real by God story. And this part is as real as me or you sitting here listening to or telling this tale. Cotton sees his mama's dog, sad, worn dress eyes that are drowned when JL says this. And he also sees JL's eyes, and they are firefighting eyes flashing like old man's sun. And she is beat up like his mama from her black eye, but she ain't broke like his mama. And he lets go of her wrist, and she goes and throws the cash on him and stands and says, go on, get then. And Cotton wants to holler filthy words at her like the crows are always doing to him, but he can't. He can't even make a sound. He just sits there watching JL walk off from the railroad tracks, and a train is coming in, by God, and she disappears behind the many colored cars like Joseph's coat his daddy give him. And the train pulls in, and it is the Big G, as the hobos called it, and it is going out east, and none of the rail workers will stop Cotton from getting on to go east to finally shake the blood of the West off himself for once and for good. And Cotton realizes that he is on the hump being the Continental Divide, and he is right smack dab in the middle of coming or going either way.
Chapter 29.
When Cotton went to leave his homestead home that time for good after braining his daddy with a guitar, I will tell you, though no one knows this yet, but I am telling you for people learned it later, is that Cotton came down from the tree and went to his baby brother who was sleeping in the shanty, and he woke him up and he whispers, come on, Comanche, let's light on out of this place. And his baby brother was asleep, but he woke up, and he was but 10 or 11, I think, and he didn't have quite the cuss that Cotton had, and as much as he feared his daddy, he feared not knowing what was out there worse, and he was scared of the dark and snakes and killing broke-back sows besides. And he looked at Cotton's boy face, which looked man hard in the moonlight, and he was scared to go, so he shook his head, and Cotton said, come on, you big baby. And Comanche Kingfisher says, I can't, Cotton, I can't. And Cotton says, why, are you scared? And his baby brother says, yes, by God. And Cotton said, you don't need to be scared, I'll take care of everything. And his brother knew he probably would, by God, but he couldn't shake the fear, for he was just a little boy and had a more tender heart than Cotton, who took most of the brunt of his daddy's beatings. And beside, like I told you, Cotton always just had a fire in his belly from the time he came out of the womb, and he did indeed kick his mama and the woman delivering him so hard that they were hurt, and his little brother Comanche never kicked no one. Now, Cotton could see his baby brother was backing out on him, for they had always said they would one day run away together. And here Cotton had gathered his marbles to do so, and his baby brother was just lying there sweating in the Oklahoma cicada mule hot night, saying, "No, I won't go." And Cotton felt mighty sad in his guts, like he'd a stomachache from too much pork that the pig farm funny boss had give them from the sow with the snap back that Cotton had shot his damn self. So he goes on, "I'll take care of you and better than Daddy ever could any day, goddammit. I can hunt and fish and cook and work, and we could ride the rails west and look for Injuns. Real ones, not the broke kind, and we could live real high on the hog, by God. Come on, you baby, let's go." And Comanche, who may be named after an Injun, but no one really knows, says, "What about the girls?" And Cotton hadn't even thought of this, but they are too little to bring. So he says, "Well, we could come on back for them after we have enough dough." And Comanche doesn't seem to care for this. And Cotton gets angry, for Comanche cares about the girls more than him. But more than that, Cotton feels guilty, like lead in his belly, for leaving his baby sisters that Comanche can't. And Cotton is just a boy, but he wonders what is wrong inside him that he could just leave his baby sisters, but he can, and he will. "God damn you, Comanche, let's get going before it gets light," Cotton says. And Comanche shakes his head, and Cotton can see in the Oklahoma big, heavy moonlight. Comanche says no, but his eyes are sad. Not dog sad, but sad, and Cotton knows for some reason Comanche can't come even if he wants to. For he can't leave the land and his mama and sisters. And Cotton knows Comanche is a better man than he, though he may be a fool. The boys just sit there in the moonlight looking at one another for a while, like this is the last time they will ever see each other. And they don't want to forget each other's faces, though they were in no danger of doing this, for they had been through hell together. And boys that have been through hell together remember each other always. So they sit and look at one another, and Cotton finally hands his brother something, and it is a fat load of cash, and Comanche whispers, "What in hell is this?" Cotton says, "It's money we earned that I kept from Mama and Daddy. Now you take it, and don't say a damn to Daddy about it. Now you hear me, Comanche?" Comanche nods his head to say he does hear, and Cotton can see that he does, and Cotton goes on, "Now you keep that money, and you help Mama and the girls with it. But don't you ever tell Daddy, he will take it and gamble and whore it away." Comanche nods, and Cotton goes on, "I'll send word for you when I get settled, and y'all can come and join me. We can do it together." And Comanche nods and takes the cash from his big brother and says, "But what about you? How will you live without the cash?" And Cotton says, "I took a little for myself, but I will earn most of it by busting it like a mule, okay?" And Comanche says, "Okay." And they sit and look at one another for a piece in the humid moon till someone stirs in the room next door, and Cotton stands up and he puts his hand on his baby brother's head and he musses his hair good. Then he slips out, and this is when he sees his mama, and she waves at him. Whether goodbye or stay, he still does not know. And that was the last time he saw his baby brother, as well as his mama and all the rest. The reason I tell you this as you sit there waiting is for to tell you what Cotton was thinking after Jail left behind the train. And as he sits there like a hobo broke down chief with his spirit and body broken and the hole in him belly aching waiting to ride the train, he thought deep, sad lake thoughts, and the clang of the train didn't mean nothing to him no more, and this made it worse. And also the fact that the minister and Mason and even J.L. had all said the same thing to him, is that he had given up the ghost of trying. They had visited him like three goddamn spirits, telling him he wasn't worth a damn for quitting, and J.L. had even pity paid him. And he could make a fine living off those winnings, damn her, for a few months and just take in the rails in America east of the divide. He thinks of his brother in the Oklahoma midnight, and he thinks of J.L. and the Blackfeet wind riding Going to the Sun Mountain, and he thinks of Fred Mason and his silly mustache and his pretty family, and he thinks of the sneaky minister who has a fire in his own holy belly, by God. Cotton sits, and the train sets in front of him, chuffing and huffing, While waiting to head east, and Cotton knows he could hop on and forget this goddang place and sky and girl and all if he would just go get on that train. He thinks about his brother Comanche and how Comanche wouldn't leave with him, and he thinks of him in the moonlight, and he misses him like hell, for a man misses a limb when he loses a brother, and Cotton didn't just lose a brother, he lost him on purpose, which is his own damn fault, damn it, and far worse a hurt. Cotton thinks again on how J.L. gave him hell and money, and he gets to boiling inside of himself at her being so ornery to him. And also, Fred Mason was a real son of a bitch as well. But they were right in a way, because he knows he is getting when the getting is good. But maybe the getting being good just means he is beat, and goddamn hell, fire, damn sh**. Cotton ain't never been beat, and he won't be beat, by God. So when the many color-coded train rolls on by, Cotton ain't sitting on the side of the track in his Indian blanket no more, and the train whistle blows as it leaves Stumptown like Cotton's tails upon the wind up into the meaty mountains of Montana as it heads out east. Chapter 30. The fire in the park, no one knows what started it, for it was not a lightning strike nor camper fire. And some folks say it was from the burnt cabin that Cotton and Jacob Two Calves had lived in that Terry and his boys had lit that night, though no one at the time knew it was Terry and his boys. Some folks say an ember flew like a lightning bug from that cabin fire, begot of ill rage, and sailed high up into the mountains to bear a fire. I did not see this for myself, and neither did you, nor anyone else that would speak of it. But if you have ever watched an ember up jump a fire and land on the ground, you can see how this could happen. For embers are like rumors. They fly away on the wind, and the next thing you know, a goddamn forest is burning down. And this has happened with a few cotton train whistle tales like embers burning down forests, which is why I am writing this to set the record straight. But anyhow, I have no trouble believing it about the burnt cabin ember lighting up the forest, for Terry and his goons were prepared to light it, but not to fight it. And I imagine old man Big Son must have been powerful angry at Terry and his boys, and he was getting back at them. For Cotton wasn't doing nothing, not even being his ornery ass self. He was just being. So maybe old man was punishing Terry by lighting a blaze from the cabin. Whatever the case, an ember caught some trees and it lit a blaze and up jumped a mountain. And the smoke was in the air in Stumptown and at the lodges, and the sun turned blood red even on the res. It was bad enough that Fred Mason went out to work on it personally from the headquarters. And he was about to fire Terry and all his crew, though he'd no proof yet they'd beat Jacob and Cotton, though he didn't need no proof. But he needed men so bad, so he sent them up into the blaze and he called the military to come help, for he feared the worst and he feared for his park and all its beauty. He left his wife and kids at the lodge at the park entrance, and Elsa and other women folk, even J.L. Carter, were getting food and supplies for the men going in to fight the blaze. No one had time to think or stop, they just had to act. For a fire does not stop nor think, it just acts, and it jumps, especially when the wind picks up and the Blackfeet wind was a-blowing. J.L. and Elsa were putting supplies for the men into trucks at the lodge, and J.L. hears all of a sudden Elsa go all quiet-like, then say, "My, my, sweet Lord, will you look at that?" And J.L. looks up, and who should be coming through the entrance of the park along the road but goddamn swaggering Cotton King Fisher, by God, worse for the wear, wind-blown and hell-bent, but striding strong like the world can go to hell. And J.L. stands up like she is standing to attention, and she just stands. But her heart, it up jumps like a flushed grouse, and Cotton is the shotgun. And she hears a bang in her ears, and her heart got hit by Cotton the shotgun coming back to fight the fire. Elsa puts her hand on J.L.'s back, but J.L. can't speak none, just stand there, watching that goddamn crazy heart-of-stone drifter come walking back like he ain't just had the beating of his life, no sir. Like he ain't never been whipped, no sir. And he ain't about to be, by God damn everyone for saying it. And Elsa says, "That man is unreal. I knew I liked him no matter how nuts he is." And J.L. doesn't say anything, just nods. Cotton keeps on walking like he owns the park until he is standing in front of Elsa in jail, and he says, "I need a truck. Which way is the fire?" And the women just stand there looking at him, and I will be damned if both their ribs didn't ache at the sight of this grown boy, fire-bellied, won't-quit cuss, acting like it ain't nothing that he is there, though he still has blood on his clothes and bruises all about him, and his hair is mussed from the tussle he took. "You need to clean up, Cotton," Elsa says, because JL is still too heart-shy to speak. And Cotton says, "God damn it, woman, I ain't got no time for a bath. A fire don't take no bath break." And Elsa laughs and says, "Go get cleaned up, you stubborn cuss. You can't go fight a fire looking like a damn hobo. Besides, you don't want them boys that beat you up seeing you look like that, so do as I say." And Cotton gets cussed irritated, but he obeys Mama Sister Elsa, for she is right. And he goes on down to the lake and strips buck naked, by God, except for his rattler necklace that Jacob Two Calves made him. He don't even care. And he jumps into the ice-cold water, and it stings and knocks his breath clean out of him, but it feels mighty fine, like a glacier baptismal. And when he comes up for air, he sees JL sitting on the lake shore waiting for him with a towel. He washes up as best he can and slicks his hair, and then he walks out of the lake naked as a jaybird, and he don't even give a damn. And JL turns her head and hands him a towel, and he dries off. And JL hands him a crisp new uniform, and he digs in his rucksack and gets clean drawers and a t-shirt and puts these on, then the crisp new uniform. Then JL finally speaks, and she says, "Sit." And Cotton obeys her. He sits on a picnic table, and J.L. combs his hair right on the part real nice like he likes. And she even puts his grease in it, and it looks nice, and he looks brand new except for the bruises. J.L. touches his cheek real soft-like when she fixes his hair, and it feels mighty nice, her cool hands on his bruised-up mug. And she is telling him with her hand on his cheek that she is glad he came back and that his string still humming her body. And he knows she is telling him that, so he looks into her flathead lake blue eyes and nods. And she nods back and smiles. And Cotton knows she is the most pretty woman he has ever seen, and she makes his heart hurt. "Why'd you come back?" she asks when he stands after her combing. And he says, "Well, everyone said I's beat, and I don't ever get beat, so I am back. I ain't running for getting beat, by God. Also, you said that you bet it all on me, 'cause I told you to, and you're right, I did, and we won. And I don't ever welch on a bet, so here is your money." And he gives her the money back and goes on, "Now you keep that, and when I get back from the fire, we can use it together. I ain't leaving off on you and the land where the world began, by God. This is my place. I feel it in my belly and bones, JL, and I shouldn't have left you like that." He says that like he has always wanted to say it to someone. Anyone. Then he goes on, "And what kind of man is going to let a forest burn to the ground, especially old man's first forest?" "Not Cotton Kingfisher," JL says. And he crooked grins at her, then he leans in and kisses Big Sky Beauty Mark Crow Hair Girl on the neck under her bowline jaw. And he is still cold from the lake, and she is warm from the big sun, so she shivers when he does this. "I gotta get," he says, and JL says, "I'll be waiting for you when you come back. Be safe, Cotton." And he says, "Always am," with his damn crooked cocksure grin like he's a goddang boy saying he will stay out of trouble, knowing he won't. "Make sure Fred makes it back safe, Cotton," Elsa Mason says when Cotton starts for a truck. "He isn't quite as resilient as you." Cotton winks and says, "He'll make it, or I won't either." And this makes the women hope and worry at the same time. Then he hops into the truck with his rucksack and a Pulaski and waves at the women folk and heads up towards the flames with JL and Elsa just watching. And Elsa Mason says, "That man is unreal." And JL says, "He really is, by God." And Elsa laughs and hands JL a cold bottle of beer. That's all for tonight. You've been hearing my novel, Busted Like a Mule. I'm Caleb Manon, and have a heap of help from Mike Ailman and Vern Windham, who recorded and edited it. It is a production of Spokane Public Radio for The Bookshelf. Busted Like a Mule is available on Amazon and Kindle. It is also at some libraries as well as major booksellers, including Auntie's, of course. Oh, and the author's front porch. For original music and more about the book, visit CalebMannon.com. Catch you next time. If you've missed any of the episodes, head over to kpbx.org to hear the podcast.